That was so beautiful. In fact, I'm inspired. Honey, I think I'm going to sing you a Valentine. No, just kidding. That would be a terrible thing to do after that. That was so gorgeous. Thank you. They are not even going to want to listen to me now. They're going to just want the angel voice. Love it. Well, good morning. Good morning again. Welcome to the West Valley Center for Spiritual Living, and I'm Reverend Karen Rice, and I am the spiritual leader of this community, and I'm here today to wish you a happy Valentine's Day. And I love you so much, I will not sing to you today, hopefully, although the title of my message is You Gotta Have Heart, and let's face it, it makes you want to sing, you know, if nothing less than miles and, oh, I did sing, miles and miles and miles of heart and all that. So I'm glad you have heart, baby. I'm glad your heart's working well, and I'm glad you have miles and miles of love for me. We went to the grocery store yesterday, and it was a frenzy of last-minute balloons and candy and red roses and stuff, you know, and we're walking by this huge department in Fry's, and Hugh stopped the cart, and he said, oh, yeah, there's all this going on. He said, will this do? Is it okay if we just skip all that and we just do this? And I said, absolutely. Good for you. Good for me, too. And then we stood there and we made out in the aisle for a little while by the grocery cart. It was really fun. You're never too old for, you know, all kinds of good mischief. So I'm for that. So happy Valentine's Day. And I wanted to create a message about love today that gives us the position to stand in where we don't feel bad because we didn't get chocolate or roses or candy or we don't have that special someone in our life. So the message this morning is going to be about our a beautiful invitation to look at self-love and to look at self-compassion, to look at that place that has a different way of looking at heart. So we're not looking at, you gotta have heart. The song is not about that organ in your body that supports your physical well-being. But the dictionary definition, the second definition that comes up under the word heart is more of what we're looking at this morning. And it says, the heart is the vital center and the source of one's being, feelings, and emotions. So the heart is that vital center. It is our vital center. You know, when we speak from the heart, we are speaking from that vital center. And that is the place where all feelings and emotions are born. It is the source of all of that. So in our experience of being human, we have this beautiful invitation to also have heart, to actually have a sense of aliveness that comes from that very core place that is the center of our being, that place where that idea of having heart is born and brought forward. So there is a lot to look at as we're looking at this idea of having heart and having it mean not just that idea of love and not just that kind of Valentine's Day love or significant other, the way we love each other in a physical way, but the way we go deeper and we have compassion, the way we learn to love having that idea of caring for each other, of having empathy and really listening to the words of that poem and feeling the truth in, like can we go through these tough times and still have that spirit of connection and the beauty and grace of life that exists no matter what's going on and as we move through to the other side of those situations. So we're doing this extraordinary thing this month, and that is that all this, not all of them, but a huge number of centers for spiritual living, different communities, are talking on themes that fit with our global heart vision. And by the way, when they first created our global heart mission vision statement so long ago, 10 or 15 years ago, they actually did the imagery around it and what it represented. And so much like the circular way we look at the way we do leadership here, they started with a heart that rippled out into larger and larger circles. And in our Centers for Spiritual Living, people all over the globe will be hearing this particular passage from that statement. We see a world in which unity with God and connection with each other is emphasized. We see a world, and that's the big stand here, is we're willing to take a stand to begin to envision the world as we believe it can be. So we see a world in which our idea of unity with God and our connection with each other is emphasized. And we do that so well here. We do that so well. As I was writing this message, I was thinking, you know, I bet every single Sunday I say that in some way or another. We end up talking about the way we are all connected, that we are all created by this one creator, and that we therefore have an importance in the way that we are connected to each other. There is this great way that we are often talking. Sometimes we say, you know, there's only one of us here, because we're really that connected. And I rather like that idea. Ernest Holmes, the founder of this philosophy, said a long time ago, and this is a really key point of the message today, and really a key point of our philosophy, and all of New Thought, really. Ernest Holmes said, we attract to us what we first become. We attract to us what we first become. And until we learn to love, love is such a good illustration in this way, until we learn to love, we cannot receive love in return. And then in this same chapter in the Science of Mind textbook where he's speaking about this idea, he begins to talk about the way there is a love vibration within us, and that our focus on this idea of love, of this bigger essence of God as love, and that love being a part of who we are, therefore that expression of love through our living is a divine assignment. He talks about this love as being an energetic vibration, and that we have to get that moving within us. That's how we attract. We get that, we meet it at the level of that vibration, and then more of that comes back to us. So we not only can't receive love until we get that moving, until we get it and we know it and we realize that it's right here, because we're always looking out here somewhere to get it, right? So until we really get it moving within us, we won't be able to receive it. But more than that, I don't think we can even see it. I think if we're focusing on the things that are difficult in life, we shut ourselves off from the presence of love. We're not as able to be aware of the presence of God's love in our very life. And so that's why when you attend classes here or study any workshops in New Thought in the greater whole, we always have a strong focus on self-responsibility. There's an accountability here that I can love you, but I can't give you love. I do not have the ability to fill you up with love. None of us could ever be, if we feel empty, nobody will ever be able to fill us up. Nothing outside of us will ever have that ability to, or capacity to fill us up. That's why we live in a world where addictions are rampant. We're still, you know, trying to work this all out and figure out how do we do it. And so the answers are always, you know, we start with ourself. The answer is always you begin where you are, you begin with what you have, and you take some of the tools and you begin to apply it in your life. We teach that there's a way to practice what we focus on, what we desire more of in our life. And as we focus on those things, our life begins to change. The single most, this is my opinion, but I believe strongly, that the single most transformative step we can take on this extraordinary adventure of learning to love from the inside out, so to speak, working this process of loving at a higher vibration, the most transformative step we could take is to love ourselves. Absolutely. To practice loving ourselves, to practice being compassionate and caring to ourselves. And so I think there's a great call here for for us to look at the idea of having immense self-compassion. Because what do we know? As we give it, as we open ourselves to receive it or enliven it within us, as we fill up in our awareness of the presence of love already established in our being, then we will have love to give and we will be more open to receive. It is really a reciprocal relationship there. So we're talking this morning about radical self-love, and I want to say that radical self-love, given in the context of this message, really could be the thing that would change the entire planet. If you look simply at the vibrational, energetic way we show up individually, and you amplify that to if everybody had a little bit of that, wow, what an amazing contribution to the betterment of living conditions everywhere on this planet. So we're looking here at a way of learning to, I think sometimes it's about changing our language. You know, I was thinking it's about nurturing our holy self, right? So this is not about selfishness, you know? And a lot of us have been raised in environments or churched in environments where any focus on the self is not good. And I would say that we have to really re-examine that. We want to get in a better relationship with ourself first, and then everything else in our lives will change. If we can be compassionate with ourself, it's going to be a lot easier to be compassionate and caring to all those other people in our lives, even when we don't agree. You know, there are just times in, you know, in relationships, you don't have to plug your ears, Charlie. This will never happen to you and Celia. But there are times in relationships where we also don't agree and we don't feel very loving toward each other. But the practice of spiritual self-love is the way that we can learn to still be in relationship, to not cut off our love that desires to naturally flow, but to keep that love flowing even if we're disagreeing. And if we could wrap our minds around this, I think we would notice that even some of our opinions about politics and stuff that's going on in the world, those things would soften because we wouldn't be stifling our love, constricting our love and holding it back. So there's a passage in the Course in Miracles that says, when you withhold your love from anyone, you are withholding it from yourself. And so we don't want to ever do that. We want to just keep that vibration, that energetic force that is love, that is God. It is that divine expression of compassion and caring and all of those things. We want to really keep that moving as much as we can. So I believe that is what it scripturally is indicated when Jesus said, love your enemies. I think that's the answer to that. I don't know how to love. If I look at a person that has done something really horrible, I don't know how to love that person. But we are all children of the divine. And so there's a way we can separate the act from the actor. And then we don't have to ever like something that we don't agree with. We don't ever have to accept it that it's okay that there are terrible things that happen in the world. But as we continue to let our love flow, it becomes a healing balm for this entire planet. But it starts with our willingness to love ourselves enough to pay attention to those ways we can self-nurture and practice that immense self-compassion. I think it's also what that scripture means, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. I think it has a real similar theme there, that when we look at perfection, the way that we teach what perfect, complete, and whole, when we talk about what that means, we're talking about our innate wholeness, that part of us that is already divine, that doesn't need any fixing or changing or any differenting. I don't know if that word just popped in my mind. I rather liked it. Could you tell? That's kind of fun. So it's Valentine's Day, and so sometimes I just want to I want to shout at the top of my lungs on a day like this with a message like this. I want to shout to you and go, for the love of God, for the love of God, let us begin to consciously practice that self-love and that self-compassion. Jane's reading, that invitation, Uriah, Mountain Dreamer. Wow, what a gorgeous poem. And by the way, I printed that last night so I could read it and kind of see if I could use it in the message, and I'm going to. But I didn't have that very last line that you read. The very last sentence that you said was not in the one that I looked up. But I wanted to read what I thought was the last stanza, minus the little addendum there. And because it's so relevant to what this message is about. She says, it doesn't interest me where or what or with whom you have studied. Remember Holmes said, you could study all the great works, read all the great books, but none of that matters. What matters is how we practice it, how we use it. It doesn't interest me where or what or with whom you have studied. I want to know what sustains you from the inside when all else falls away. I want to know if you can be alone with yourself and if you truly like the company you keep in your empty moments. Wow, think about that for a minute. Do you like the company you keep in those alone and empty moments? Because there is a difference between being alone and being lonely. You know, there is a way we can walk this path in which we never feel that we are alone, you know. And for me, I remember the very first time I saw that footprints poem and with a little picture, and there's a set of footprints in the sand. And it was such a good visual. I like those visuals. They help me really embody an understanding of the presence of God everywhere and that we really are never alone. So I like this, and really that I think it is not only is this a beautiful poem, the invitation, but I think it is a divine invitation for us to step up and see if we really do enjoy our own company. Now, I heard some information this week that has kind of rocked my world a little bit, you know, and it's going to sound a little different than other conversations we've had on Sunday mornings here, but there are some new. There's always going to be new. Isn't that great? I'm so excited that there's always going to be new studies published and new research, and neuroscience is just filling us with all this exciting stuff. I think I have a whole shelf of books on just the brain, and they're all fairly current books because that stuff is hot right now, and I'm fascinated with it, how God and spirituality and our brains, how our brain works and all of that. But some of the some researchers now are saying that our brain is actually wired to be critical and judgmental. Now, I was thinking about that. When I first heard that, I thought, I'm not sure what to say about that, because I think I've read the opposite from other points of view. Although I think even opposing points of view eventually come back to be saying the same thing. So listen to this. This is how I reasoned this week after I read this information. So neuroscience is saying that the default mode of the brain is to fall back on that judgmental and critical sort of way of thinking and seeing and being. And I see that as that way that we are always comparing ourselves, sort of measuring ourselves, trying to see if we fit in with the norm, whatever the norm is. I mean, that's the most amusing part for me. When I think of trying to be normal, I mean, who would I be like? I don't know anybody normal. But it does imply that, you know what the norm is. It's when they average things out and they throw out all the specifics. So there really is no, what norm is really nothing. It almost waters it down to have very little meaning. But I was thinking that, you know, that is the way that we the way we walk through this adventure called life, that there is some element of trying to keep up with the Joneses, just so that we don't feel too different, so that we don't feel too separate. And yet, in our very need to kind of fit in, we separate ourselves and we pull ourselves out and we have these silly beliefs, whether we recognize them or not, that we're just not quite as good as that person, whether it's the Joneses or the Browns or the Smiths or whatever. And I think that it's tempting for us to look at the faults of other people so that we can just feel better about ourselves. Now, none of this is new. None of this is, you know, new to any of us. But what I realize is all of that is very isolating. It is the way we have an experience of separateness when we don't feel as good as, or we feel like we're not quite normal enough, that we have this experience then outside of the group. And we can never be outside of the group except when we decide on our own, on our very own, it's inside work, remember that we don't fit. Now, here's the hard part for most of us. Everybody sitting in this room, in fact, there's probably not a soul alive, doesn't feel different. We live in finite form, in separate bodies. It is no wonder that we have periods of feeling separated and even lonely. But none of us are free from feeling that way. And that's kind of the hidden secret here, is that we get in our own little world, and if we don't watch what we're thinking about, we begin to start believing that kind of stuff. It's just a bunch of BS belief system. It's just a belief system, right? So the human journey is about waking up to those truths and realizing. And I think here's the good news. If it is true that we are wired, you know, I always go back to fight or flight, you know, the dinosaur. When I say fight or flight, I see myself being chased by a dinosaur, and I'm not very happy. It frightens me to have that image in my mind. But I think that's where we get this idea that the brain is wired to be critical, because we have to be discerning, so that if a dinosaur is chasing us, we know which cave to dive into and hope there's not a big bear in there, I guess. I'm happy to be alive in West Phoenix at my age. So the brain is wired for that. It has this way that it criticizes and judges. But as I pondered all this stuff, I thought, but don't we teach children to have critical thought, to do critical thinking? Isn't that what the education system is all about? To train us to be attentive to things, to be more discerning, to be able to make good decisions. And then as we learn those skills, as we move into our adulthood, you know, then it's sort of up to us to how much we use it. But isn't that what we do? Is we actually train our young people to be sensitive and to make choices and to be good, upstanding citizens, we all hope. So if that's true, here's where it got really exciting for me, then if indeed we are wired, that it is the brain's default mode to just go into criticism and judgment, then maybe, like I've said so many times before, this just sort of validates it, so I'm feeling really good about it, that the whole purpose of living here is for us to learn to be more compassionate, to learn to have and practice self-love. See, it's very fitting. It's very fitting. So we start by looking outward, but then we take it with practice. We take it, we pull it inward, and now we have some skills and tools we can use. So I then went the next step, and I was thinking about children. Kids can be really self-centered. It's beautiful. We think it's so cute and all that naivety. And then we spend, as parents, we sort of beat it out of them, you know? It's like, no, you have to be polite. You have to fit in. You want to do well. Be kind. Be nice. And so we start taking away that which starts as self-centered. But we have to be self-centered at first. Because think about it. Everybody here was in a womb once. We don't remember. Most of us don't. I guess they have, you can go to counselors and do regressions and stuff and have memories of that if you like, and it was probably pretty nice to be in the womb. Temperature's always right, you're just floating in this ball of water, you got got a wall-to-wall waterbed you're in there on, and you're never hungry because this cord, this umbilical cord, is just feeding you. You have everything you need, and you're always safe and contained until, and it must be pretty scary to be born, until birth, and then suddenly your whole universe is no longer like it was. And then we come into this world, and then some of us have moms and dads, and some of us have siblings, and then maybe there's grandparents, maybe even aunts and uncles. You start fanning out to the extended family, but still, for a baby, an infant, even a toddler, the world is still contained in a fairly small area. And guess what? When we're babies, the world does revolve around us, right? We can't do anything for ourselves. We are totally dependent on other human beings who, whether you have an opinion about how that all unfolded in your own life or not, you're here, so something went okay. And so there's we should really be able to understand that there is that natural process of being fairly self-centered until we get social skills, until we get out in the world in a bigger circle other than just people telling us how adorable we all are all the time. Sometimes I look at my gorgeous little 3-year-old granddaughter, Annabelle, who's going to be 4 in April. She's so cute. Oh, doggone it. She's got those curly locks, and everybody adores her. Total strangers come up to her and want to just do her little, you know, cheeks because she's so freaking cute. And she's pretty self-serving. She wants what she wants when she wants it. We're trying to have an adult conversation, and she's telling us, no, you guys be quiet. I want to talk now. You know, and so they kind of own the world for a while. And then I was thinking that even toddlers or babies learning to talk, you know, sometimes the first word is mine while they're grabbing something from another child or from, you know, from mom or dad or babysitter or whatever. And then there's that way that they're so demanding of our presence. You know, if you get the baby to sleep in your arms and you go to put the baby down and you try to tiptoe away, baby opens up his eyes and sees nobody's there. Or they see, worse yet, see you leaving the room. Oh, my goodness. You know, then there's a lot of chaos. And there's some demanding crying that, no, I'm not going to lay here alone. So there comes, it is natural. If you look at the stages of development, you know, as they're growing, it is natural for babies to have separation anxiety. We witnessed that last week. Baby's in the front row. Baby gets passed off. Both the moms come up here to sing. And what happened to baby? Baby wasn't very happy. That baby cried really very. That baby let everybody know that, no, I want to be up there in mom's arms, right? And that's what happened. Did you see at the end of the day, baby was fine up here while they were singing. They're up there, and she's just in her arms, and they're singing away, and it was kind of a beautiful thing. I think it's a very gorgeous thing. So kids are a really good example of how we then grow into life, and we learn our skills, our social skills. So now they're old enough to be at the sandbox on the playground, and what happens? Well, you still have some arguments over who gets to play with what toys. Maybe there's a little sand throwing going on, and then there's the block stacking, and somebody else always wants to knock down the blocks, and so we continue to train these little ones to be more discerning, to play fair, to let the other person have their turn or whatever it is. And these are all good things. These are certainly all good things. We older adults appreciate witnessing those good things in children, I just noticed. What I see is, and what I wanted to say about all this, is that children give us a great example in getting their needs met. And we can observe that we grow beyond childhood into adults, but we just create other ways of getting our way or believing what we want to believe. So we have defense mechanisms, and we learn how to rationalize things in our favor. We have the ability to get angry or to fight for what's ours. And so these cannot be bad things. The ways in which we are sometimes critical and judgmental I guess what I want is for you not to be critical and judgmental about being critical and judgmental. I want you to see that there's a natural process here, and that the answer is in the way that we return to love, in the way that we come back to loving ourselves. And it is really about retraining our brains. And everything we do here and everything we have done here for all the years that this philosophy has been around is about retraining our brains. Change your thinking, change your life. It's that clear. Ernest Holmes said, the individual brain is limited. The individual human brain is limited. But we can train ourselves to tap into the universal mind, which is unlimited. So it clearly is about being deliberate in the way we work our thoughts. And Holmes called it asserting your individuality, you know, the way you stand up for yourself and make choices in the world. He says that when we do that, when we assert our individuality, we are rising above the law of averages. We are actually using spiritual law to change our lives in the way that we apply a new thought. We go back to the first cause, we plant a new seed, which is a new thought, and we create something new in our life. And when we do that, it brings freedom rather than bondage, joy in place of sickness. And then he throws in this little clincher and says, but we have to learn to judge not according to appearances. So, my friends, as you notice what you're seeing or think you are seeing or think you are experiencing in your life, and it doesn't feel like a favorable within your being, and you would like to kick that love vibration into gear so you can have a better focus, a different focus, the best way to do that is to notice. Just train yourself to notice when you're not feeling the way you want to feel, to stop, take a breath, and I just call on the power of the Holy Spirit, help me to see this, whatever this is, help me to see this in a new way. I am willing to open myself to have a higher perspective, because sometimes right in the moment, it doesn't feel very good or look very good. So there's always a higher view. There's always a holier perspective, you might say, to be free of judgment, to have self-compassion. And that self-compassion is really the ingredient that paves the way for us to be more gentle and tender in our experience of life and with each other. Trust the capacity of your heart, dear ones, as the vital center, as the source of your being, and feel the love of God within you, and then move from that space. Allow that to be the consciousness in which we walk through life. So let us just take a moment to shift gears and to step into that place of praying sacred words, to anchor this message in consciousness in a way that we can take it home and use it on this glorious day of Valentine's. So I would just invite you to get comfortable where you're seated. Take a nice deep breath. Open your heart and your mind to the presence of love right here in this very room. Just feel the love of God within you now. It is indeed an energetic movement of life itself, because it is the activity of spirit within. I feel the love of God within me, and I know that it is indeed the movement of all things good. For there is a power and a presence. It is a power for good. It is right here, right now. It is from that perspective that I speak these words of prayer. I feel the love of God within me, and I know it is that infinite intelligence of all the universe. It is that which allows us to be brought forth from the womb of all creation. It is the activity of spirit of love, of life and power expressing through us and as us. There is only one mind in the universe. It is the mind of God. And that mind is my mind right now, and it is the mind of every person within the sound of my voice. And as we become confident in this divine life that is given so sweetly, we begin to sense that divine compassion. It is like being held sweetly in the hands of God. And so that which I know to be a caring and a loving presence of the divine is that very compassion that we call on from within so that we might see it everywhere around us, so that we do not constrict the flow of love, we do not hold back the flow of life, that we are active and vibrant in every way, bringing God's love to this planet, allowing it to express through us. And so I speak today a word of blessing, a word of healing, that if there are any appearances that are physical in terms of illness or discomfort in any way, I simply know that right there too is that full presence of God. And as we remember that, we awaken to a greater truth that we already are perfect, whole, and complete. And so we easily step in to this beautiful, perfect expression of vibrancy and vitality and excellent health. I know wherever there are strained relationships of any sort, that right there in the very heart of that is the presence of God's love, that healing, beautiful, light-filled love that is an emanation of wholeness itself. And wherever there is any appearance of limitation in any way whatsoever, I simply know that we live in this unlimited universe, and that as we acknowledge the unlimited nature of the way that the planets move and the perfect harmony of the way all things align and the way the seasons change and move, simply know that we come to a higher perspective of our own unlimited potential. So I say thank you, God. Thank you, life. Thank you, Infinite Spirit, for all of these blessings, for these recognitions, for these truths being revealed at this time. And it is from that spirit of deep, deep gratitude that I simply release these words into that divine law that always responds affirmatively. I let it be, and together we say, and so it is. Amen.